Okay, hello everyone. Good evening. Welcome to the Astoria Room. There's a few yet to come up from the bottom eating their dinner still. They miss out. First in, first served on the seats tonight. My name is Karen Pedersen. I work for an organisation called City Bible Forum. If you have been to any of our events in the past few weeks, particularly our John Lennox event at Adelaide University last Tuesday, that may have been your reason for being here tonight. And welcome. It's great to look around and see some familiar faces, but for me, who've been involved in City Bible Forum for a couple of years now, there are a lot of unfamiliar faces. So if it's your first time to one of our events, particular welcome to you. And I do apologise about the timing. We've sent out a few emails that are apparently different to the website, and we only picked that up this afternoon or as people came through the door here. So I'm sorry if you've been waiting around for this to start for some time. City Bible Forum, just quickly, I'll do a quick introduction. We're a national organisation that is concerned about the conversation about God and faith. Jesus in particular comes into the workplace. It's a place where many of us spend many of our waking hours, and so why keep it in the church on a Sunday? So that's what we're about and why we are here organising this event tonight, thinking about the big questions of life. Last week we had 3,500 people come to Lennox, a couple of different events that we had on, to consider how science and faith might fit together. And so tonight is about continuing that conversation, because we often hear, I don't know what your view is, that I often hear, I'm a school chaplain part-time, that in our 21st century Western culture, often people say, well, science and faith just don't fit, they just don't go together. And yet here we have gathered on our panel some top scientists from South Australia who at the same time wholeheartedly believe in a loving creator, God. And so they're going to bring that before us to say to you that faith is not a quantum leap into the dark, but is something much more. And so we're going to explore that interplay of faith and science. And hopefully, if you have questions, some of those questions will be answered tonight, at least in part. Of course, we don't have all the answers. These scientists are sitting here saying we don't have all the answers, and we don't. But we have a lot that we can say to, I'm sure, a lot of your questions. Just a quick, some comments on the format of how we'll do this evening. I will, in a moment, introduce the scientists to you. And then each speaker will have 5 minutes. I'm going to interact with some of them in those 5 minutes about what they do, and excuse my back of here, and what they believe. And then we're going to have a drinks break of about 10 minutes where you can write down your questions. You'll find on table, so those who aren't on a table have to move forward and grab a pencil and a paper for questions. And don't hold back on the questions. They are prepared, the panel, to say, I don't know the answer, if they don't. But they're happy to have you throw anything at them. And having those questions put before us makes the evening enjoyable for all involved. And also, it helps us to move from something that's theoretical to something practical. These are fellows who aren't necessarily high theologians, although Tim at the end is the head of a theological college here in South Australia. But they've apply their faith practically, and hopefully that will come through in what they have to say tonight. So use those pieces of paper, and then Craig and Fergus, two of my colleagues, have got boxes. They'll come around and you can drop those questions in the box during that break. Now, that's how that will go. And at the end, our panel, I think it's okay, gentlemen, to say you'll be around at the end of the evening, but we will wrap things up at about 7:45, and we have to close up here at about just after 8 sometime, but they will be able to stay around and have discussion with you further. All right, so just to introduce the speakers to you then, our panel, if you do not know them, there are these pieces of paper. You're welcome to pick them up now to have a look at little summaries of who we have before us if you do not know them. Can I first of all say here we have Rob and Graham in the middle. They're not going to like me for saying this. They both have been South Australian Scientists of the Year, so top of their fields, and they'll explain a little bit of that later, as well as have Orders of Australia, Which brings me back to Dan, who is a doctor of biochemistry. And Dan, that puts a bit of pressure on, doesn't it? You're a bit younger, you've got a few years ahead of you. Order of Australia, Scientists of the Year, South Australia. There you go, something to aim for. And at the end, we have Tim Patrick, who is also a scientist, has worked for CSIRO, first class honours in science, I think, at Sydney University. Is that right, Tim? Worked for CSIRO for a while, but then went to study theology. And so he is our doctor of theology here tonight on our panel, who will bring that perspective, I'm sure, to some of the questions. So, gentlemen, a quick question before I give you the floor a bit more individually. Rob, I'm going to ask you, first of all, you have a funny accent. You come from Zimbabwe. And I'm going to ask you to talk just what do you miss most about Zimbabwe?
I guess you could say there are a number of things. One is the weather, because I think this winter has reminded me that going back to Africa would be a very good move. The second is biltong. For those of you who don't know what biltong is, it's dried meat, and it's nothing like jerky. And thirdly, the fact that there are no atheists in Africa. Everybody believes in something. Most of the time they believe in something that I don't believe in. But you can mix with people, you can talk with people on the assumption that everybody believes that there's a spiritual world to relate to.
That's interesting. My local butcher the other day said he has great biltong because a guy from Zimbabwe kept coming in and saying, it's not right, it's not right, it's not right. So I'll give you his name. You can go. My husband thinks it's very good. I think it's disgusting. Okay. Graham, you're approaching retirement. So do you have any idea of what you're looking forward to most about that and what you might do?
I don't really see retirement as something that one aspires to. One really avoids it. You really transition from one phase of life to the next. The great things about the situation I'm in now is I do totally control my own time. I do not have a university or a hospital boss who I report to. I do what I choose to do. I control the time. I control my projects. I don't normally get up to the alarm now, so that all works really well. But the plus side of that is I've actually published more papers in the last 2 years than I have in any other 2 years in
my
life. So I'm actually productive because I can focus on exactly what I believe I need to focus on. That's really retirement
for
me.
Okay, so yeah. No such thing as retirement for you. Daniel, what would you do if you didn't choose science as your profession? Any other ideas or thoughts?
I think after hearing Graham, I want to retire now.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's not a question I've thought about a lot, but a while ago I was on Kangaroo Island and out at Cape Border Lighthouse, and there was a ranger there called Ranger Dan. He was out in the middle of nowhere, seemed very peaceful and quiet. I thought, yeah, I could do that. He had some very bad jokes as well, so I thought, right. That's a thing for me. But I think in reality, the disadvantage of that is that I wouldn't be able to share the gospel with people. So I think whatever I wanted to do, that would be an important part.
Yes, John Lennox, after he did his stint here a few days in Adelaide, went to Kangaroo Island. Apparently he was always interested to go. He went for 4 days. He said that's enough. A bit too quiet for him. I'm sure he likes the engagement too on his faith and talking about those things. Who do I have last? Tim, have you been to any nuclear weapons manufacturing facilities lately?
Not lately, no. Karen was looking for a question that would kind of open up a different part of my life.
You gave that away. I didn't write it down, obviously, but I just remembered it. Yeah.
In one of my former lives, I used to work in the UK for an engineering company. One of our contracts was to the nuclear weapons establishment. So I'm completely unconnected to anything we'll be talking about tonight, but I think it's kind of cool that I got to go in and visit the nuclear weapons manufacturing establishment. Not sure I agree that it should be done, but if it is, it's nice to walk around and have a look. So,
what do you see? Just an ordinary factory?
You actually see a whole bunch of guys wearing jeans with their feet up on the desk, kind of looking pretty vague and disinterested, like, you know, lots of workplaces, I suppose.
Fantastic. All right. They're all going to take the floor now for 5 minutes, but I'm going to start here with Dan, and I'll ask you questions, Dan, to get us started. And I'm going to ask you to tell us about your work, a biochemist. What does a biochemist do and what are you working on currently?
Yeah, so biochemist is really looking at the biological chemistry aspects of life. Most of my research is medically related, so I'm really interested, or my research group is really interested in how cells in the body sense oxygen, and particularly what happens when they don't get enough oxygen, which is related to diseases like heart attack or stroke, or particularly relevant in cancer also.
So something you're working on currently?
Something we're working on currently, a particular aspect is cancer cells are very different in the way they use oxygen and metabolise, but so are the eyes, the retina. So we're trying to work out why the eyes, cells in the eyes, particularly the retina, are different to the rest of the body.
Yeah, well, okay, big questions. Important things. We're Christians here tonight. Tell us a little bit about your Christian faith, when you became a Christian, and what does it mean for you to be a Christian today?
I've been a Christian for about as long as I can remember, but certainly gone through periods where, in terms of my belief, it's really been challenged. So I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family and a church community where I was encouraged to question. So not just accept, but to question why. And being a scientist, that fits quite well with my nature, I think. Probably the most difficult time for me was when I started university, because I, in some ways, came from a bit of a sheltered environment there in terms of faith and what I believed. And university is supposed to be a place of rational thinking and open thought and ideas, but I found it a place where, to be a Christian, it was really very confronting, and belief in God was often mocked and derided. So I was really challenged about my faith, not just what I believed, but why I believed it. So I really spent a bit of time looking at, is there anything rational behind what I believe? What is the evidence behind it, and why do I believe it? I guess an element of doubt there was really beneficial, and coming through that, I think my faith was really strengthened.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about that? What in science, perhaps, has strengthened your faith, or even challenged more specifically? Can you think of examples?
Yeah, a few examples. I think some of the things that have been really challenging are people. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first day I started here in Adelaide, within the first week, there was a very strong atheist in the lab, very outspoken, who found out I was a Christian. Whether I liked it or not, I was confronted. And he cornered me literally, and we had a discussion that went for between 1 and 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But in the end, we gained mutual respect for each other because we had both thought a lot about what we believed and why. So although it was challenging, I think it really... it means that you think about what you believe and why. In terms of things that, where I see God, I mean, looking at processes like replication, how inside a cell can replicate 3.5 billion base pairs of DNA in minutes and get it right time after time. It's just an amazingly complex process. I can see something like that, or see the universe and how big and amazing it is, and just think about the God behind it and how amazing he is.
Yeah, fantastic. I won't ask too many questions. That's a great little summary, because I want to give the floor over to those who have questions elsewhere. So I'll ask you to hand it on to Rob. Rob, I'm going to leave you to speak for a few minutes. And for all of you, this goes for all of you, I might just say your name quietly into the microphone if you go over time. So the clock is on. So over to you.
So I was 14 when I had two great talks and two great publications that came my way. So I grew up in a family where my parents were open to going to church, but I don't think at any stage were they passionate about Christianity. But they encouraged me to go. And one night I went, and I heard this strange guy who said he was an evangelist and he'd be in the park the next weekend. And I went and listened to him, and I was pretty convinced by what he said. And over the next couple of years, I really discovered the publication, which was the Bible. Within months, I came across another person who gave me a great talk and then gave me this. And I bought this the other day off the internet. And it's Life magazine, very appropriate. And it's the first time I ever learnt about DNA. It's just a fantastic colour demonstration of DNA. That's 1963. It wasn't long after DNA was discovered. And that set the course for the other part of my life. So basically, I've always tried to stay in step, my intellect and my spiritual beliefs together. And I just don't know why people have problems between science and Christianity. I mean, I don't think I've had a day where I've said I can't be a Christian because of science. I know that probably 50% of what I've been taught and believed in science is no longer true. The whole nature of science is to question, to investigate, to disprove, to come up with another hypothesis, and gradually you start to unravel the truth. So what I believe and practice now, in a couple of years, will probably be utterly wrong. That's the nature of science. What I believe and practice in Christian faith, I believe, is not going to change. I think that that is set in stone, and it's also a dynamic going on. So my relationship between Christianity and science has just been one that I marvel at what I discover when I look into science. That's why I love science. I love medicine because it's so exciting. Everything is just so thrilling. And when I go to the Bible, I discover why and what the purpose is behind it all. So I do appreciate there'll be people here who don't necessarily think the same way that I do, that there's a harmony between the two. And I guess that'll be part of discussion. But for me, that's never been a challenge. The two just go utterly together.
Fantastic. Thank you. Professor Norman, before you put the microphone down, can you tell us how you became South Australian Scientist of the Year?
I had good friends. one of the things that you discover in science, you start off as an individual and, you know, you have to get a publication and maybe a PhD, but you realise soon that you can't get anywhere without a team around you. And as I've become a leader, and I led the Robinson Research Institute for several years with more than 500 people in it, my philosophy has always been you can achieve anything in life if you don't mind who gets the credit. And I've just had a lot of really good people who've been fantastic. And people on the committee looked at me and said, wow, that group's going really well. Who's in charge? And I happen to be the person.
Okay. Professor Young, do you have a similar story, different story, about your South Australian Scientist of the Year experience?
Yes, I do, both similar and maybe a little bit different. But I think the first thing is what did the award actually mean to me? And I had quite mixed reactions to that. It clearly affirmed the fact that we were doing things that people judged with this level of quality and to be relevant to society. But I found that it was my teams, and I would say the same with Rob. I got where I am because of the teams that I had. But my team celebrated that much more than I did. I felt self-conscious and rather embarrassed about it. They loved it because they saw it an affirmation as being worthwhile. It opened doors. There's no doubt that it does that. I did find myself asking the question, what did that mean to my fellow Christians and to God? And my reaction was probably not as much as what it did in the secular world. And it really made me think of the situation with my father, because my father was really, he was a Salvation Army officer in Melbourne who played a major role in pioneering police court social work and really defending the disadvantaged and representing the disadvantaged in difficult situations. And a high court judge called my father into his office one day and said, you know, we want to give you the OBE, will you accept it? And he said, no, I'm not in it for that. And I must admit that when I was told that I was up for the Scientist of the Year award, my initial reaction was the same. But then I realised that it had benefit to other people around me. So that's actually how I felt about it. And, you know, my reaction, and Rob has an Order of Australia like I do, and my reaction to that was, you know, rather the same. Who really does value it? It opened doors, but the value's to the broader group.
So it's good to have you here. Can I ask you some other questions about then? You said you've written some papers and you've got time for that. Tell us a little bit more about your work and what you're working on currently.
Yeah, well, you've given me a 5-minute limit, so I'll be really quick. I work in two areas. Firstly, colorectal cancer prevention, especially through screening, and so I've had a lot to do with getting the National Bowel Cancer Screening Program up in Australia, and I consult with a dozen governments around the world about them getting their program up. And I think the most exciting thing is we've now just discovered blood-based molecular markers that are going to change the technology that's really applied in that setting. So that's one of the two things I now focus on, is getting that to work and replace the other sort of tests. But as a gastroenterologist and involved in cancer prevention, I've been very interested in the interaction between diet and the whole process of oncogenesis. So oncogenesis, for those who are not scientists here, means the process of cancer development. Cancers develop over years or decades, not overnight. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, we really discovered a novel, very simple approach that actually not only helps to the strategy for preventing cancer, but improves colonic, bowel absorption of fluid and electrolytes. So we've come up with a dramatically novel way to shorten the problems of acute diarrhea. Acute diarrhea is the major killer of children in developing country, over a million each year. So we have multi-million dollar grants from Bill Gates now. We're working in India, Malawi, Zambia and various countries around the world and putting this science into practice.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Certainly people can ask more questions later to that. As a Christian, you've just shared that you perhaps grew up in the Salvation Army. Your dad was a Salvation Army officer. Tell us a bit about what's significant of your Christian walk or experience, or what's significant about your Christian faith today.
Yeah, there's a lot that could be said, but again, I'll try and keep it quite short and straight. I mean, I've been brought up in a situation where social accountability is absolutely crucial, and where, in fact, I see very much ministry as a Christian not just being a ministry to the spirit and the soul, but ministry to the whole person. So, you know, to bring a person to God, you've really got to deal with the immediate day-to-day needs, and that's really been the philosophy behind the Salvation Army and the holistic ministry. So, and that fits with me very much as a doctor, and I guess that actually has a lot to do with how I see science, because I see science as a fantastic tool for improving the lot of society in many different ways, and I'm grateful to God that I have those gifts that mean that I can assist in scientific developments that really do change the way things happen in society. So I see that total consistency between science as a tool and my religious beliefs. Just turning that around in a slightly different way, I've been a Christian pretty much as long as I can remember as well. And I guess, what did that mean early on? I think I perceived that having a relationship with God was a worthwhile thing, but as a young teenager, what did that really mean? And over the years, my relationship with God has grown. I mean, you don't become, in my view, a Christian overnight, and you certainly mature in the process. And for those of you who know the behavioural sciences, there's a model called the trans-theoretical model, or stages of change model, which I might say we use for improving stopping smoking and preventing lung cancer and improving participation in bowel cancer screening. And we've done the research that proves that. Now, a number of churches are starting to look at the stages of change model to see how you actually move people through their Christian experience from awareness through to being involved and then maturing in that. So I see my process of my relationship with God as being a lifelong one that just grows and grows and gets more fulfilling. In the end, I think the conflicts between, I think Rob said it, the conflicts between
science
and religion are invented by people who sit at the poles of that process. I mean, there's a scientist who don't perceive you need God, and they put forward hypotheses that they believe, you know, in, which still remain just hypotheses, to explain certain things. And at the other end, you've got some Christians who really take a perspective that the Bible isn't consistent with science. I mean, it comes from both directions, so I'm probably going to annoy both people here tonight because I don't sit in either of those camps. But I think if you insist certain things, and forgive me for saying this, some of you, if you insist that the world was created in 7 days, you're actually dumbing down the wonder of God's creation.
All right, well,
yeah.
That's a big question that one is often debated among Christians. We might not touch on that. Tim actually may touch on that a bit later. Tim, we touched on... thank you, Graham. We touched on you being the head of the Bible College of South Australia. Quick summary of how you landed here and in the head of a Bible college.
Yes, okay. So I was studying in the UK, finishing off my doctorate over there, and my passion really is actually for the local church. I think the local church is where I would most like to be, but I actually think that you want people working in theological colleges who are frustrated church workers, people who have a passion for the local church. So anyway, I got a call from people here in South Australia who were looking for someone to head up the Bible College, and they looked at what I had to offer, and we had a conversation, and though it wouldn't have been something that I would have predicted, it seemed to be a very good fit. And my wife said at one point, when we were going through this whole process of determining whether or not this is what we do, she said, you know, if we get offered this, we'll just have to take it, because it's clearly a very good fit for us.
And so far,
I think it's a good fit.
Fantastic.
I've only been in the job since January, so still early days.
How did you find your first South Australian summer and then this winter?
Yeah, my first week at work was that week, you remember, in January where every day was above 40. My second, and I cycled to work, right? So my second day of cycling was 46.
Wow.
I thought, this is not how I'm going to do it. So that was hot. Having said that, I found the winter colder than I expected. When you live in the UK, everything's so well insulated, and you kind of T-shirt and shorts in the house, but here it's been a bit chilly.
It's a bit chilly and overcast and rainy. It will get better. Tim, you, I think, did your higher study in theology in Reformation church history or Reformation theology. To those who don't know anything about theology and studying that, how do you specialise and why, etc.?
So if you think about... theology, which is really just a fancy word for what we know about God, this has kind of evolved in Christian terms over a few significant seasons or periods. The early church, they had councils, and from them the creeds were developed. So if you ever go to church, you see the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, things like that. That's the product of years and years of theological conferences, getting together and working out what they believe about God. And there was another big period in the 1500s, which was the reformations that occurred across Europe, when there was a real fresh understanding of things that had perhaps been lost during the medieval period. And so I went into study a bit more Reformation history, and particularly Christian views about the afterlife as they were shaped during that period.
Great. So you're a scientist at CSIRO. Tell us a little bit about that. And was there any point in your scientific career or studying science that was a challenge to your faith?
Yeah. So I worked at CSIRO for a number of years as an experimental scientist. I worked in mineral chemistry. So if you know about that, I was involved in looking at phase relationships of different synthetic minerals, and we got to do a lot of fancy experiments and write them up and hopefully make a contribution there. I have to agree with what's been said before, I never found the conflict of science and faith in that arena. And we had some fantastic scientists there. But the thing you find is the better the scientist, I think the more humble they are. And there's actually a bit of arrogance that comes from that scientist that says, you know, I'm a great mineral chemist, therefore let me tell you about God. And we just, I was fortunate to work with a group of scientists who didn't have that arrogance. And our chief scientist in the division that I worked in was a very humble man. And while he could tell me lots of things about molecular bonding in various crystal structures that I was interested in, he wouldn't presume to speak about God because he would, you know, it wasn't his area. I think we call it academic trespass, where someone says, I know a heck of a lot about one thing, therefore I'm going to make kind of lofty proclamations about other things, even if I don't really have any grounding in them. So I never found that conflict.
But don't be afraid to tread on academic or intellectual trespassing today because we want you to challenge and push those boundaries. And so we're going to, thanks, Tim, we're going to take time now, take a break. You can go to the bar. Mark is at the bar ready for you if you want a drink. And, of course, you can get food after our session finishes about 7:45. The food is open until 9 o'clock downstairs. So take time. Please write down your questions and we'll collect them in the box over this next 10 minutes or so. Thank you. When everyone's ready, we'll get started. We've got a lot of questions to get through, and it's fantastic to see people engaging in these questions. Some great questions, so I hope we do get through them. We've bought ourselves a little bit of extra time. Congratulations, scientists. You didn't take all of your 5 minutes. That was fantastic. And I'm going to start with a question that is very common. There's a number of these, and I'll read a few of them out. But if you have a question about Darwinism, evolution, Big Bang, I'm going to throw them together. But at the end, if I don't cover what your concern is, you're welcome, of course, to ask the question again. So the question here is, what is your view on the process of Darwinian evolution? Do you think there is enough evidence to support this theory? Do you see areas of the natural world, such as the beginning of the universe or the information content in DNA, is pointing directly to an intelligent creator? A little bit different, sorry. Where is the research into abiogenesis, origin of life? Do you believe we will ever see a scientific answer to this? How old is the Earth? Can you explain the theory of evolution? Is it real? How does the Christian explain evolution? I'm just throwing it all in the same basket. Sorry, Craig. That's my boss saying stop. One more. It says, why has the theory of the Big Bang gained so much momentum in recent times? That is a bit of a different one and a good one. So who would like to begin on evolution? Go ahead, Rob.
Well, I think evolution is a theory which was proposed by people before Darwin, and then Darwin came up over many years with an idea. But our concept of genes only came with a Christian monk from Mendel, and he played around with peas in the back of his abbey where he lived, and published, I think in 1902, the first paper that really told us about genes. And over the course of the next century, people worked on evolution, came up with DNA, and then we have people like Dawkins that now think it's the gospel. But we need to remember that before Darwin, there was a guy called Lamarck, and Lamarck was a French scientist. And what he believed was that the environment changed your genetic or your composition so that you evolved differently. So Darwin would say giraffes have got a long neck because there was mutations, and therefore the long neck ones got to the leaves and therefore survived. Lamarck said, well, the environment meant that the green leaves up there meant that a giraffe had to grow its neck, and over several generations did that. Lamarck was completely thrown off the scientific planet for 150 years. Work in our laboratories have shown now that much of what Lamarck said was utterly true. The environment can change the expression of the genes, and that can be transmitted through many generations. And there's a biblical verse we've just been looking at where in the Old Testament it says the iniquities of the father will be, I've forgotten the words now, delivered for three or four generations to the children. That's what we're finding in science. It's not evolution. It's a different way. So to me, it doesn't matter whether evolution's true or not. I work on the basis that everything is changing. As I said before, what I believed 30 years ago in science is not necessarily true today. There's a lot about Darwinian evolution that fits very well with nature, and I'm going to defend that where I have to. But I'm totally open to change, and I'm totally open to, you know, leaving this life and entering the next one and being told that what I believed was utterly untrue.
Can I just add a comment? And I don't need to add much because I think Rob has said it eloquently, but It seems to me that there's two perspectives that you can come from here, and if you go to Oxford and you go to the Museum of, I think it's the Museum of Natural History or whatever it's called, and you go up on one of the balconies, you'll pass a room which actually has on the outside a notice that this is where Huxley and Archbishop Wilberforce had their great debate about evolution. It struck me as ironic that Darwin didn't go, Huxley went in his place, and God didn't go, Wilberforce went in his place. But nonetheless, the reality of it was that both of those men in their area were phenomenal people. I mean, Huxley was a phenomenal scientist. Wilberforce was an archbishop, but also a great champion of social change. I mean, he was one of the people that really stopped slavery, you know, in terms of British law. So here were two incredibly effective and competent people actually having an argument about, you know, the issue of evolution. And in a sense, and Wilberforce, they got upset. Wilberforce was upset because it was abhorrent to him, the idea that a human might have evolved from through being a monkey. Now, I'm not exactly sure that evolution is exactly saying that for a start. But it was that abhorrence of that idea that puts a lot of people off. And then at the other end, there is the tricky bit about the Bible, you know, and how it describes creation. And I mean, my view as a scientist is they're not incompatible. You've got a Bible that's been captured in words that are several thousand years old. You cannot expect it to use a form of description and phrase that's actually consistent with modern scientific understanding of some of the issues.
Tim, as a theologian, he has spoken...
I'd love to hear his view.
Yeah, just on that, in terms of the account of creation in Genesis, in the Bible.
There's a couple of things. The question arises because it's seen to be a sticking point for science and faith. Okay, so at one level, it doesn't actually make any difference to how any of us live today, whether you evolved from some earlier life form or whether you appeared like that doesn't change the moral decisions and the relationships you have today. But it forces the God question. Is the Bible true, or is what we learn from evolutionary biology true? I think I take the point that there's a lot that we see in Darwinian evolutionary theory that is, it's a good theory, and there's a lot of it that is completely... makes the best use of all the evidence we have. There are still some questions that it leaves unanswered. But bringing it down to the sticking point, the question is, does it contradict what the scriptures say? And that forces you back to look at the first two pages of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1 and 2, that really talk about the creation. And the question you have there is, what kind of texts are they? Now, one thing that I think is sad in our generation is that people are clumsy and naive with the scriptures, and think that the whole Bible is something you can kind of open like a big book of facts. You know how you, when you're a kid, you get the big book of facts, and you open up and you turn this page, oh, this is an interesting fact. You know, there's more tin cans than people. Amazing, you know. And you think it's that kind of book. And it's not. The Bible unfolds a narrative from the first page to the last, and that narrative is presented through a lot of different forms of writing. So in the middle of the Bible, for example, you have the Psalms that are songs, and they're poetic, and they're written to be poetic songs. You have philosophical reflections in things like the book of Ecclesiastes. Jesus spoke in parables. The book of Revelation is a vision. Throughout the scriptures, you have very different kinds of writing. And if you take them all like it's a big book of facts, I don't mean to be condescending, but it's kind of pre-Sunday school way of coming at this. So I think you see where I'm going with this. My contention is that the opening, at least the opening page of the Bible, is not meant to be for us a chronological and mechanistic description of how the world was created. I'm not saying that because I desperately want it to harmonise with what I think we learn from science. I'm saying that because I don't think it's written that way. You look at it, it's written like a poem. It reads like a poem. For anyone, if this was not a loaded question and you were just asking me this objectively, is this poetry? Everyone would say, of course it is. Now, you can convey great and lofty and mighty truths through poetry. In fact, some of the most powerful ways of telling someone you love them will be through a poem, not through a paper published in a scientific journal. And the Bible has lofty and mighty and powerful things to say that are profoundly true, but they're coming at a completely different angle. So this is a long way of coming to it, but my answer is... I think we need to ask if the Bible really does present for us a mechanistic form of the creation and development of the world and the people in the world. And it's when you answer that question that you find out if we really have an impasse here or if it's actually a straw man argument.
Thanks, Tim. Just coming back to that last question I asked about why there's so much momentum in recent times gained for these theories. I know, for example, I had a biologist from Sydney University come to a school in Sydney and speak about the theory of evolution and just her experience, like you are, scientists and Christians, and it caused a great stir of the science teacher saying she called it a theory. And it was a bit of news to me because it is a theory. They were very cranky about that and we worked that through and that was okay. But it just was the point made that it's a very emotive thing for people. It's gained traction. Has anyone got comment to that? Which is more a sociological question probably, but do you have any comment or experience with that yourself?
I mean, it goes back, I suppose, to the Scopes trial in the US, doesn't it? The monkey trial, where Scopes was, I think this is right, was the guy who was basically provoked to teach evolution and to flare up the debate, to take it to the church, as it were. So it's from the start, this debate has been deliberately inflammatory. And it's still used that way today. People use the question of science versus faith as an argument starter, not as a genuine search for understanding.
I tend to agree, and from experience, it's often people at the extremes who are posing it as it's one versus the other. But in most cases, they're not as informed as they should be on the matter. I think as a scientist, science tells us about the world we live in. We can understand things like the how, maybe not so much about the why, but certainly about the how. And when we find out information about how the world was made, how it does change, I think that's informative. It tells us a lot about how God has done what God has done and continues to do what God does. I don't think it takes anything away from God.
Thank you. Professor Norman, this is one specifically for you. Often as Christians and scientists, particularly in your field potentially, there are ethical questions, and this is one of those. How do you feel your research and manipulation of the reproductive cycle reconciles with your faith?
So if I was to choose an area of science that was the most controversial for a Christian, it would be IVF and reproduction. So from the 1960s, we've been living in a reproductive revolution. That's when the oral contraceptive pill became widely available. It changed people's behaviour. It gave people sexual freedom and ways of behaving that perhaps many Christians don't think is appropriate. When I was finishing my medical course and I was wanting to go into what's termed obstetrics and gynaecology, I would not have been able to get a job unless I was prepared to do abortions, terminations of pregnancy. And so that's kind of got me more into science. I said, I'm not going to do that. That's against what I believe in. And therefore, I went and did a PhD in various scientific aspects. And then I got a job here in Australia where I was running laboratories and I was also seeing patients. And I happened to be in one of the best reproductive units in the world at Queen Elizabeth. And that was the era when IVF was starting to take off. And I had to face a whole lot of issues that were uncomfortable, like when does life begin? Is it an offence to freeze an embryo if that's a living person? What happens if you throw an embryo away because it doesn't have any chance of implantation? Who's entitled to become a parent? You know, can a single person become a parent? Can gay people become parents? Can we pass eggs that are donated, produce an embryo, and then that's passed on to someone else? Can we do surrogacy? As you know, that's topical at the moment. And the church in the first days of IVF aggressively attacked anyone doing IVF. And so I came into that field where I felt Christians wouldn't have approved of what I did, but I knew that I wanted to be in that area. And I thought, if there's not a Christian in that area, we're just going to hand it over to people who don't believe. And reproduction is the most remarkable thing in life. Those of you who've had children or had friends who've had children, it's amazing. You get this one cell, which is an egg. The next day when sperm is added, they're two little cells. When we put IVF embryos back, they range between 8 cells and 128 cells. And then 9 months later, people come back with this amazing production, this wonderful baby. So for me, I'm sorry I'm going on a bit, but this is the marvel of creation and the marvel of science. And why should I not be in it? And why should I not be making contributions in that area? So I see Christians quite regularly who will tell me, I never want my embryos frozen. I totally respect that. But at the same time, there are others who believe that human life only begins when that embryo is implanted into the mother. I'm never going to be able to answer that question, but I've got to live with the uncertainty by caring for people and respecting the life that we're creating.
That's a great answer. Anyone else want to comment on that? No? Move on. Graham, got your hand? No, you're right?
No.
With that one? Okay.
That's not my field.
Yeah, okay. Graham, I'm sure you've had similar sort of moral, ethical questions come at you, but here's one in terms of getting published. Is it harder to get published in a journal any findings or beliefs which give rise to belief in a creator God? If so, why do you think this is?
Well, I can't give a clear answer to that because I've never, ever been involved in that process. But let me give you a bit of a concept of what I am. I'm very interested now in looking at ways and means in which the church in missions in low-income countries can actually contribute to the well-being of the people, not just an evangelical process, but through, you know, improving their lot in life, either health or thereabouts. And so it becomes a question of can you, to me, it's, and look, you hear where I'm heading. I'm a very practical implementation person. It becomes a question of can you use an effective, vibrant church congregation to actually improve the lot of the broader community? So minister to the person in a holistic way. And you certainly and absolutely can. Mm. And of course, there'll be some church communities who will do this by a process of prayer. There'll be other church communities who do this by a process of getting out and putting processes in place, and some that do it at a combination of those approaches. And in fact, one of the challenges that faces the mission people that I work with at the present moment is they say, you know, we really believe that this can bring benefit to the community. How do we do that? And I said, well, what we actually need to do is to develop a randomised controlled trial where we actually use the power of the congregation to make some aspect of the healthcare system work. Now, we haven't yet got to setting up such a trial, but we do plenty of health implementation research, so in theory it's not that difficult. If we got that up and we tried to publish it, how would that go? I can't particularly see a barrier. I mean, if you take an objective approach to something, you test it by the scientific method and you prove it or you disprove it, my belief is you ought to get it published in a good journal.
Here's another way of asking that question. You're well known as scientists. Do people know you well as Christians, and is that a comfortable fit?
You know, that's a very, very interesting question, because I think the thing that faces a lot of young Christians, and it certainly, you know, if we're implementing our belief, is this meant to be an evangelizing process where we grab the nearest person on the shoulder and say, are you saved or not? Mm. Okay. Or is there some other way to do it? Now, I'm the other way to do it. I take very seriously the biblical concept that I am created in God's image. To me, being created in God's image is a bit like a mirror that other people could see God through me. So I need to behave in a way that my Christian belief becomes apparent. I know some incredibly successful businessmen here in Adelaide who are Christian. I've met them in social environments where I've not known they've been Christian, but within a few hours of a couple of meetings, it's clear to me that they are a Christian. And very occasionally I've had feedback to me that's implied that people have read that of me without being overt about it. So I think an effective Christian is about showing that through everything that you actually do, and hopefully people will see that. I don't feel if you're not really meant to feel proud about that, but to be honest with you, when people do see you that way, you do feel that your belief really is playing out in your day-to-day life.
Words and actions. Yeah. Rob or Dan, anything to say to them?
Yeah. Getting back to the original question about publishing research, particularly working in a molecular area, I don't think science can answer the why question very well at all. It's very good at answering the how question. So if I was to take some of my molecular research findings, and even if for me it would, I could see, you know, God's hand there, science is not a good tool to demonstrate or prove that that is evidence for the existence of God. So if I were to put that into an article I tried to publish, I'm sure the rest of the article may be accepted, but that would be taken out. But in the same way, if someone who didn't believe in God said, well, this is evidence for the non-existence of God, I think once again the editors of the journal would say, well, these experiments can't demonstrate that. They're not designed to demonstrate that. That's not the power of this sort of science. So I think in that sense, either one way or the other, since science is not able to answer that question, it wouldn't be included in a scientific publication.
Yeah. But in the public dialogue, scientists, world famous scientists, and we're coming to a question here, do come out against Christianity and against a belief in God. So they sometimes hold that platform. And so this question is, world famous scientists come out with guns blazing against God, example Stephen Hawking. Are the world leading scientists who are pro-God too few and far between, or are they concerned about their credibility being hurt? So that's pushing that question a bit further. Like, should we, as Christian scientists, be defending against the likes of Stephen Hawking who say, no, there isn't?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think in terms of my own faith, being challenged, as I said, when I started university, looking for not just evidence and reason for believing in God, but are there other scientists? Am I the only one? Are there well-known, respected scientists who do believe in God? And we've got two very good examples here of people who do. But there are others. They're not always as outspoken. And I think, once again, because they don't necessarily say that science is able to answer that question. I think some of the ones who are more outspoken in terms of atheism are of the opinion that science can answer the God question, whereas many others aren't. And there's many examples of famous scientists, Nobel Prize-winning scientists. I think 1997 in physics, the head of NIH in the US, Francis Collins, who was also head of the Human Genome Project, is an outspoken Christian. And I think for many years he wasn't very outspoken at all, but because there was a lot of criticism about the fact that science and religion wouldn't mix, he felt the need to really publicly come out and clearly state what his beliefs were, and he's written a book about it. And when he became head of the NIH, there was a lot of criticism by people saying, hang on, we can't have someone who's a Christian who has religious beliefs heading up the NIH. But, you know, there would have been no issue with these same people if it was an atheist. So he was very clear about his beliefs, and of course he still has that position. So if you look, I think you can find many very well-renowned, well-respected scientists who are also people of faith.
Francis Collins was interviewed by a well-known Australian atheist on ABC. What's his name? Philip Adams. And Philip Adams, who's very against Christianity and speaks very publicly, we give him a forum every night on the ABC to say so. He said to Francis Collins, if you keep speaking like that, I might believe in God. He's had such a beautiful manner in presenting his belief, and yet he's at the top of his scientific field. Yeah. It's great. If you can get a hold of any of his interviews and so forth, it'd be a great thing to do.
Just as a sidebar, I saw today a friend sent me a list of all the Nobel Prize winners ever, and there's been, how many has been, a few hundred, more of them have been Christians than not.
Wow. What do you say to that? What do you think the reason might be?
Well, I have no idea. I was surprised by it, but yeah. I don't make a value judgment. I just say, how about that?
How about that? Yeah. Thanks, Tim.
You find yourself wondering why people like Dawkins are so aggressively against God. I mean, what's his motivation? I mean, I don't even see a need. In one sense, I don't see a need to respond to him because I'm wondering what he's really on about, to be honest with you. What's his actual problem?
Be good to... Maybe someone has an answer to that. Come back to us later. What is his problem? Okay. Assuming... why so aggressive about it? Okay, here's some anthropological questions about Noah's Ark, particularly. Assuming anthropology is a science, does anyone have a view re the flood and following events? How does the biblical account fit with anthropology? Could you please discuss the viability of Noah's Ark and the floods in regards to the practical considerations of this and what we know today about science? A couple of questions there. Does anyone want to have a go at that?
I'm not sure I understand the anthropological bent on that. I understand the question about the flood, you know, can you accept a worldwide flood, all that kind of gear. But I'm not sure I understand the anthropological implications. I think I could say some things, but they might be just talking around the point rather than to it.
Does anyone want to put a question to that in terms of it was just Noah and his family, presumably, from the story? Or just, okay, so from the world flood and what do we know from science has it, yeah, so that goes away from the anthropological question.
We're back, lots of these questions arise for us from the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, which I was mentioned to you before. It's my contention that at least Genesis chapter 1 is a poem. It's also quite clear that by the time you get to Genesis chapter 12, you're in a very read-it-off-the-page type history. And so the question is, at what point between Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 12 do you arrive at the history? When do you move out of the poetic, the figurative and those kinds of things and into the history? Now, you might say that does occur prior to Genesis chapter 5, where we start the flood narrative, in which case then you need to account for the fact that there seems to be a historic record of a worldwide flood. A lot you could say. A couple of things very briefly that may or may not be helpful depending on what the questioner was wanting to know. One is that the flood narrative is actually not unique to ancient Israel. So what you find is there's lots of parallel accounts of floods at the same period in surrounding ancient Near Eastern cultures. Seems to be something that happened, or at least it seems to be a way of describing a set of events that took place at that time. And what's happened in the biblical literature is that that story has been presented through the lens of the history of the people of Israel. In my conception, that's the right telling of the story as opposed to the others. As to whether it was a worldwide flood or not, that's a good question. And, I mean, the point of the story is really what you need to ask to get to the root of that. The point of the story is that the whole of the world was so depraved that God wanted to wipe it out. That's the point. So the function of the flood in the story is to wipe out depraved humanity. The question you then ask is, at that period of time, if you can pinpoint which period of time we're in, it's quite difficult to do that, to what extent was humankind covering the earth? And so you go from there. There's a lot more to say about that. I feel like I could kind of go off on half a dozen different sort of tangents, but I don't want to do that because I'm not quite sure exactly what the question is we're looking for. But I think, again, there's that question of what part of the scripture you're looking at here and to take it with integrity on its own grounds and then not to force it beyond what it's saying, but to read what it is saying and understand especially what the point of that is. And the what's patterned in the flood narratives in the early chapters of Genesis we see recurring later in the New Testament, where it's appropriated as a metaphor for what happens through Jesus' death and resurrection and how that has significance for all people.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Tim. We've got quite a few questions to get through, so we'll just touch on them. And people, if people have further questions, they'll come back and stay. I just want to make sure we finish on time, as we said. Some scientists criticise Christianity because it does not change. Is Christianity open to new knowledge? And Rob, I guess you touched on that earlier. Of course.
So I think in the Bible we have history and we have poetry and we have the interpretation of how Christians react to the God who is there. And to some extent we have to say that our faith is immutable, that what is written down is correct and that's the way that we're going to live our lives and we're encouraged to follow it. However, the modern world has many things that come up that the Bible doesn't necessarily answer. I still don't know whether women are allowed to wear hats in church, for instance, and cover their heads and whatever. And I'm not sure the Bible ultimately is that interested in it and whether it was just a historical issue. But if we're going to fight our whole life about the immutability of women covering their heads in church, then I think we're going to fight each other forever. So I guess the secret is trying to work out what is, to use, was it John Howard's term, what is core and what's non-core. And I think we know, those of us who have a faith and have experience in God, what are the core features. And those are not going to change. But there are going to be a whole lot of other things that are in the Bible that perhaps some Christians will say are immutable, that are changeable, and a lot of them are to do with the way that people behaved and the society in that time. But what God has given us, I think, is unchangeable.
Quick question then, coming maybe back to Tim, is the Bible falsifiable? Can we prove...
Is the Bible... Well, actually, Christianity is the only major world religion that says, have a swing. So Christianity does not claim to be an abstract philosophy or a set of theories that, just are kind of untouchable. It claims, for the large part, though we've said there are different types of writing in the Bible, it claims to be history. And so Christianity is quite open to people saying, stick it under the microscope and subject it to historical analysis. And people do this all the time. So you have any number of people doing archaeological work to verify or try to disprove what we find in the Bible. You have any number of people trying to dig up, look through any number of records and documents and history to either falsify or to prove what's in the scriptures. Christianity is wide open to that. And to be honest with you, that is something that gives me a great sense of peace about the Christian faith. I think if you believe something and the thing you believe does not allow itself to be tested, I'm worried what's going on there. There's something, is there fear involved? Is there something there that's defensive, that is not open? Christianity is not like that. It says, absolutely, crack it open and ask all the questions, historical, philosophical, scientific, archaeological, whatever you like. The thing is, to date, and this is one of the reasons Christian faith holds water, nothing has been found that undercuts what we find in the scriptures. Now, there's a lot of things you can't verify. That is, you can't say we've got evidence to prove that this miracle happened other than what's written in the scriptures. But the things we can prove, the locations, the history, those sorts of things, they gel quite well. And the more archaeological research that goes on, and there's a heck of a lot of this happening, really does just seem to line up quite closely with the histories we have in the scriptures and the things we read there. The short answer is, yes, Christianity is there to be interrogated. Go for it.
Can I just add something to that?
Yeah.
But like, say on the story of Noah, like the kind of the science kind of contradicts it now. So you can withdraw and say it's a metaphor. So isn't there a tendency that whenever there is a problem, you can actually withdraw and say it's a metaphor and so it becomes unfalsifiable?
Yep. So I'd say two things to that quickly. One is I'm not aware of what it is that's falsified, whatever you've said about the Noah, the flood narrative, but happy to talk about that. The other thing is you want to be open to new information. So if it turns out that you find a piece of truth in one field of study that causes you to need to reassess truth in another field of study, you shouldn't be worried about that. And if you do discover that actually, for example, you find a piece of information that says it seems that we haven't been reading this part of the scripture right, then it says, well, that's okay. Let's see how we read that part of the scripture right. I'm not saying that's a kind of retrieval position and, oh, heck, how can we salvage something from here? But I'm saying if you've done this well, then what it really means is we're actually getting closer. We're drawing closer and closer to the fullness of truth. And that's a great thing.
Can you, here's a question for anyone, open it up. Does it take as much faith as a scientist to not believe in God as it does for a person to believe in God? So as a scientist, do you often look at your colleagues who are very anti-God or atheistic? Do you think it takes as much faith as a belief in, as a scientist to not believe in God? Next question.
Yeah, I'd say it probably does. And you can find a number of scientists who don't necessarily go looking for God, but people like Paul Davies, who come to the conclusion that there is likely to be a God out there, even if he doesn't know exactly who or what it is. And you'll have other people who are quite adamant that there isn't. But I think if you're going to be definite one way or the other, it does take an element of faith. And I think that element of faith is just as great for an atheist as it is for a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Any others, comments? Okay. Moving on, this is a hot button issue at the moment in the church. Is there scientific evidence of a gay gene, or is it purely sociological? Anyone want to have a go? Yeah. Okay.
I think, I don't know that there is scientific evidence for a gay gene. Maybe there is, but it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because what's behind it? And you may find that the gay lobby would like to find this evidence, working on the supposition that if it is so, then that validates homosexual behaviour. So you say, we've got a gay gene, it must be part of nature, it must be okay. But you could go the other way and say, well, if there's a gay gene, maybe we can cure it. Like if we can find a cancer gene, maybe we can cure it. So it's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure where it leads you, and I suspect people asking that question might want it to lead down a certain path to a conclusion that we'd like to find. It may not lead down that path. It might lead the opposite way as well.
Rob?
I think we need to recognise that many diseases have got some genetic component to them, but they don't have a single gene. So there's not a heart attack gene. There's not a multiple sclerosis gene. There's not a whole lot of single genes. And we've got some very, very powerful genetic tools now where if we take 10,000 people and we screen their whole genetic code, we come up with some associations that, you know, there might be 100 genes that are perhaps slightly more common in this disease than something else. And I'm pretty sure that many of the things that we're going to discover in the future are not going to be just one gene, because we probably would have discovered most of them by now. It's going to be on the lines of how do a whole bunch of slight variations together with an environmental impact plus personal choice, because, you know, like our heart attacks and things like that, a lot of it is personal choice. It's all going to combine together. So genes, environment, slight changes in choice are all going to combine to explain why we're getting certain conditions. And I suspect that when it comes to bisexuality or homosexuality or heterosexuality, it's going to be a combination of all these. There may be a slight genetic tendency, but I'm sure there's not a gay gene. There's likely to be environmental influences. There's likely to be personal choice. It's a combination of where we get to.
Yeah, I wanted to follow on from Rob's idea and maybe try and give you a practical example of the issue without answering the question about the gay gene. I've worked in colorectal cancer high-risk groups and people who have inherited tendencies to get colorectal cancer, and in some cases that's due to a very strong, for those of you who understand genetics, dominantly inherited tendency, say with DNA mismatch repair genes and so on, where the chance you'll get the cancer if you carry that gene is 80 to 95%. But then we have a lot of people where colorectal cancer falls in the family, but we can't identify the gene. And again, there's a multiplicity of risk factors out there. And for example, one of the things, and we also know that there's a relationship between diet and lifestyle and colorectal cancer risk. So the question becomes, do you inherit that, or is that an exposure to your lifestyle? Now, in fact, we're seeing more and more examples across the cancer field now where there's an interaction between what you do in your environment and what your genetic makeup is. So, for instance, we know that the people who are most susceptible to have an increased risk for colorectal cancer because they eat excessive red meat is people who actually have a fast acetylator phenotype. So you've got an interaction between the amount of red meat you eat, whether or not you eat red meat, and what you've inherited from your parents in terms of your acetylator phenotype. They actually interact. And then you can start to find a multiplicity of other factors that do this. So I think we need to understand that there's no such thing as a genetic effect that's independent of an environmental effect and vice versa, and it's much more complex than a single gene. So I suspect that whatever the basis of being gay is, and I don't have the faintest idea what that is, and I suspect it's more than one thing, is that it's going to be this complex issue of interaction between gene and environment, and it's multiple and it's difficult.
Nature-nurture thing.
Yeah, it's the nature-nurture thing. Yeah.
Fantastic. We're going to finish the formal time of questions. I'm just going to quickly touch on the questions that if you're interested in having these answered, stay around and ask them or come forward for those. Otherwise, you can go. What is your opinion about human consciousness and does God influence it? After John Lennox last week, his lecture on about science and Christianity, why doesn't science answer everything? Afterlife, what are your theories on the afterlife? What do you have to support these theories? That's a really interesting one. Mathematics is described as the language of the universe, and nature is mathematics, therefore the language of God. And so there are some other questions, and I'm sorry I didn't get to those. But hopefully you had a few questions answered. And as some people reported to us after John Lennox last week, they had a few questions brought to their thinking that they had never thought of before, and that's the value of a night like this as well, to give you those questions to ask. Can I just point out, we'd love your feedback. A lot of you wrote on these already, your questions, and so you might not have those, but if you can find a piece of paper to give us feedback, or you'd like to hear more about our events coming up, we have some events coming up in a little while. Michael Jensen is another theologian who's going to talk to. The question, is it possible to believe in God anymore? Is it possible to believe anymore generally? We also have discussion groups that we're forming on the back of the John Lennox events. A lot of people have come and said to us, we want to continue this conversation. We're forming discussion groups around, or book clubs, around John Lennox's book, Has Science Buried God? So on those feedback forms, can you very clearly say that you're interested in joining one of those? We've got various locations around Adelaide for those. There is a free copy on the table, Craig, if you want to hold up The Essential Jesus. If you don't have a Bible, that's a part of the Bible that tells the story of Jesus. If you're interested just going to the source, there it is. Feel free to hang around. Oh, and there's other things you can pick up there. Jesus for Skeptics. And there's another magazine that has an article written by John Lennox in it, if you're wanting to read more there. Again, please stay around for drinks and head down to downstairs for dinner. I'm going to say thank you particularly to these fellows. I just have something to give Tim. If you can grab, can you grab the first bag there? from behind the screen. Actually, the man who has provided them is doing that for us. Did you know that these come from Blackerby's? Look at that. Mr. Blackerby's himself can hold them up. And inside his little Blackerby's bag, you can find in there some sort of... your wife put together what?
Astronaut ice cream.
Okay. She tried to get a scientific theme happening in the chocolates from Blackerby's. Yes, Galaxy, they're fantastic.
This is $1 million bar. Combined knowledge is worth obviously $1 million each.
And as close as you'll get to $1 million, Tim, being a theologian. Yep. Maybe.
Scientific process to make some squids. It's not as easy as what you might think. And there's some plain old chocolates as well.
Okay, did you set that up, Graham? Because that was great promotion. Blackerby's, Adelaide's best sweet shop, lolly shop, I should say. Can we put our hands together for thanking our panelists? And we also have these for your wives. I suggested to Craig that the blokes might not like the plants, so these are for your wives, we've decided. So there's one for each of you. Please don't forget to take them and you get the chocolates. I don't know if that works, but there it is. So thank you. And so feel free to come forward and continue the discussion. Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight.